This parsha, Parshat Pinchas, speaks about the one of the stories in the parsha is about the daughters of Tzlofchad. Who was Tzlofchad? Know anything about Tzlofchad?
That's why we're here.
Yeah, yeah.
It says, but it doesn't.
I know. I just have to look.
It says right here, but stupid. That doesn't mean.
Right.
Tzlofchad was a man who died in the desert. The question is why he died. In any case, he died on his own sin. Whatever his sin was, he died on his own sin. And his daughters had a complaint to Moses. And that's what you're going to read. That the first feminist in the feminism in the Torah. They were fighting for the rights. And they won. And let's read a little bit. We'll see what happened. Go ahead.
A petition was presented by the daughters of Tzlofchad, son of Hefer, son of Gilead, son of Macher, son of Manasseh, of the family of Manasseh, Joseph's son. Their names were Malcha, Noah,
Machla,
Noah,
Chagla,
Milka, and Tirza.
Noah is a very popular name today, right, Noah? In Israel, Noah is also a girl's name, not just a boy's name. In America, too.
It's got a hyphen in it.
But it's not Noah, it's Noah.
Noah. Noah.
But Noah, like...
It's not Noah. I'm telling you, Noah is the name in Israel. Noah in America, too, is Noah.
Right.
Oh, Milka.
Milka also. Milka is Malka. Like Malka. And Tirza is also a very common name in Israel. The five girls, five daughters of Tzofchad. Okay, continue.
They stood before Moses, Elazar the priest, the elders, and the entire community at the tabernacle entrance and said, "Our father died in the desert. He was not among Korach's party who protested against God. He died because of his own sin, and he left no sons."
They came and told them our father. They told them about their father. You know where our father is? This is right before they entered the land of Israel. This is 39 years later. They tell them a story. Their father died in the desert. You see, regular people did not die in the desert. People just didn't die in the desert. They got old, they died. In the desert, if you died, it was because of a sin. If not, you didn't die. Therefore, the people who died,
the whole generation died.
Oh, not because they got tired and broken. Because they sinned. And everyone died by the age of 60, right? And it was, the sin was for the people, the punishment was the people from 20 to 60. The people didn't want to enter the land of Israel. Every year, 15,000 people died on Tisha B'Av. That was the day they cried that they don't want to enter the land. That 15,000 people dig their own graves, said goodbye, made goodbye parties to the family. Hello. You surprised me. You came.
Yeah, it's like everything.
Okay, don't worry. We'll still accept you.
I know. Sorry. You have to suffer.
Then... they said goodbye, they dig their own graves, and they died. But nobody died out of an accident. Oh, he was in the tall building in Florida. He was there. No such thing. People died because of a sin. Then they say to him, "Our father died in the desert. But he didn't die because of the sin of Korach. He wasn't a part of Korach's fight against Moses." That's what they tell them. What they want.
"Why should our father's name be lost in his family because he did not have a son? Give us a portion of land along with our father's brothers.
They were worried about their entering the land of Israel. The land of Israel be divided by families. And their father would get, if he would be alive, he would get a share in the land. If he would have sons, the son would inherit it. Now they don't have sons. Says, at this point, we should receive it. That's what they said to Moses. Continue.
Moses brought their case before God.
Moses brought the case before God. Not bad, huh? Just put him on hold. Wait. I lost God.
That's better than the red telephone.
When was another time that Moses was asking God what to do?
It's quite often.
When? Not tell me
the
one.
The Jews with the meat?
Yeah. The Jews with the meat?
They were complaining.
About the
complained 1,000 times.
Doing the water stop too.
Yeah. asking, like he has a questioning to a Jewish law, he doesn't know what to do.
Like 2 weeks ago, we had this.
Yeah. It wasn't so long ago. I know.
It just happened.
Yeah.
You know, people ask me what I teach. I tell them every week I teach the same thing.
We're not spring chickens anymore.
The calf?
The golden calf. It was a story that people ask with them, what should he do? And he said, I don't know, I will ask God.
Isn't it spice?
Spice, God got involved without Moses asking him. Moses knew what the right thing to do.
Was it Korach?
Moses didn't know what to do. Moses turned to God and said, God, open the mouth of the earth and swallow them up and get rid of them.
The story we were reading.
Google when Moses says God something.
No, we'll give up.
Rabbi, when?
It was a few times, but the one that we learned before was when the second Pesach, a group of people, right?
Yeah,
a group of people. Pesach Sheni, guys. Pesach Sheni. Moses told them, wait and I'll ask God. Here, Moses didn't say, wait and I'll ask God. You know why? Because I'm going to speak about the Shabbos probably. There are 4 places in the Bible that Moses turned to God what to do. He didn't know, and he waited for God's direction. 2, he asked God, and 2, he didn't ask God. We'll get to it, why in these 2, in order to not, this will be for Shabbos, probably. But in the story of Pesach Sheni, because it was a matter, and they needed to know right away if they can offer a sacrifice, Moses says, Imdu, stay here, put him on hold, wait here, I'll turn to God right away, God ask God. Here he says, Moses brought the matter in front of God. The case before God. It means it wasn't right immediately. He says, I'll bring it to God. Because here it wasn't a matter of right away. Because it's going to Israel. We didn't enter the land of Israel. It's not an emergency. Then he took it to God. Then there is other places, but it's a different story. Okay, continue.
God spoke to Moses saying, the daughters of Zelophehad have a just claim. Give them a hereditary portion of land alongside their father's brothers. Let their father's inheritance thus pass over to them.
God says, yeah, they're right. The daughters, you tell your wife, you're right. That's what they tell them. What God is saying, you're right. Give them a piece of land. The father's land, yeah.
Speak to the Israelites and tell them that if a man dies without a son, his inheritance shall go to his daughter. If he has no daughter, his inheritance shall go to his brothers. If he has no brothers, his inheritance should go to his father's brothers. If his father had no brothers, his inheritance should go to the closest relative in this family, who shall then be his heir. This was the decreed law for the Israelites as God had commanded Moses.
You see, the law in the Torah is that the sons inherit their father. The daughters don't. It's not in today's Jewish law. They will always try to make it that everybody inherits brothers and boys and girls, everybody gets it. If the father is smart enough, he makes it clear in his will, because he can decide who he wants to give his inheritance. But biblically, it's the sons who are receiving it. You need to understand the daughters get married, and their husbands get from their husbands, so to speak. Especially when it comes to land, you see, when Moses divided the land to 12 tribes. Now, here is the problem. If the daughter is from the tribe of Menashe, she would marry a son, a boy, from the tribe of Judah. Then before long, the piece of land belongs to Judah in the third generation. Then now, there is a piece in the north, belongs to the tribe in the south. You understand? The whole thing will fall apart. And that's why the idea is because the tribe goes after the father. See, Jewish or not Jewish goes after the mother. Tribes goes after the father. Then because of the father, then you want the sons to inherit and they will stay within the same tribe. That's the whole idea. The daughter, if she marries a man from the other tribe, she's a part of her husband's inheritance.
This is not different from British inheritance law, like royalty.
Yeah.
How it goes, it's the same way.
Really? It goes by the sons?
But then by the daughter, then by the, you know, brother of father.
Oh, yeah?
The same way.
They learned it from the Bible. Where is it? In England you're talking about? Or yeah. Anytime?
England.
Oh, England. Royalty, you see? We are royalty. That's why I'm trying to knock in everybody's head. Jewish people are royalty. We just need that because we don't have this kind of palaces and this, we are not royalty.
Yeah.
Royalty is royalty, you are born royalty. Royalty is who you are. It's not how much money you have. Royalty is in the genes.
So I have a question,
Rabbi. I told somebody, to be a fancy person, it's not about how expensive it is, the things that you buy. It's who you are. It's, go ahead.
So the implication here is, that, or maybe that's the rule, I just don't know it, is that the tribes should stay the tribe. You shouldn't mix tribes.
You shouldn't mix the land of the tribes.
But, well...
The people, no problem.
No problem.
No problem. Just the opposite.
So this actually brings up a point that I just thought about. So the daughters will inherit. So the father doesn't have sons... Three daughters will hand the land, right? But then three daughters get married. What happens to the land?
Ah, that's a good question. We don't have it here, but in two parshas from now, God, the family, the leaders of the tribe of Menashe came to Moses to complain. They will take away the land. That Moses called the daughters of Tzofrat and told them, yeah, you have to marry somebody from your tribe.
Yeah, okay, sorry.
You can marry anybody you want from your tribe. Because of this. It was this generation was a special law, yes. Yeah, because of this problem, yeah. And don't worry, they just like you, they came in to complain and we'll lose the land, what's going to be?
But again, if it's all for the land,
mm-hmm.
and the tribes intermarry, things will happen with that land.
It happened, yeah.
So the implication is if you don't want things to happen to the land, you can't intermarry even before.
No, but girls have no problem because they don't inherit. They can go. They join the other family and finish. And the boys stay with their own land and with their people. Used to be the style that the son stayed with his parents. Uh-huh. The daughter joined the son in his business, so to speak, in his piece of land. He inherited the father's land. He got the father's everything. And he was a part of it.
So the boys really have to be careful. More
than the boys stayed. Even if they marry somebody. This is such a locking cup. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah, close it. The next time you cannot make me a locking cup. Then the sons anyway stayed, you understand?
Mm-hmm.
Even if they marry a daughter from a woman from another tribe, they brought her home. It used to be that the daughter leaves your parents' home and goes, joins the husband wherever he goes, wherever he lives. Not like today you come to live with your daughter wants to live next to your mommy. Mm-hmm. It was more this direction. Okay, here comes a source. You want to read? On Nachmanides.
Is Moses indecisive? My literal interpretation, Nachmanides. They spoke this way because they thought that Moses hated Korach's party more than all other sinners who died in the desert, since they defied him personally and fought everything he did. They thought Moses might say out of hatred, let no one extend kindness nor be gracious to these orphans. Let their father's sin be remembered. Therefore, they informed him that their father was not among them.
Oh, okay, we will talk about it later. Let's read the Rebbe Sicha. Michael, you want to continue?
Yeah, Moses didn't want to appear biased. The Torah relates that when Tzelophehad's daughters approached Moses and requested a portion of the land designated for their father, Moses did not dwell on the question and try to resolve it. Instead, he immediately brought the question before God. Did Moses actually lack the ability to answer them? Rather, commentators explain that the daughters of
The question is, Moses, the question is that Moses did not know the answer. It takes a genius to figure out if the sons don't want it, that the daughters will do it. Moshe could come up with the answer by himself. Why Raidway says, I'm turning the world, what a good question, I'm turning it to God. He had more complicated question in his life. He could discuss it.
Because they're good, so they don't claim that he's prejudiced against the
Then the Rebbe explains something very interesting. Why should he be prejudiced against them?
Because they there was an uprising against them, right?
That was 39 years before. What 39?
People hold grudges.
No.
Not Moses.
Not him. I'm said the people.
Let's read the answer. We'll see. Did Moses continue? I'm sorry.
They're relating their portion that their father was not one of the Moses' enemies. He was not among Korah's party who protested against God. Hold on, but let me ask you a question. So this is a daughter's... remember like you were talking about the one who wife said, hey, you stay over...
No, that's not... That's On Ben Peles, no.
Right, so
Mr. On. On survived. On didn't die. Slofcha died. But Slofcha had nothing to do with Korach. That's what happened.
Okay. It was an act of flattery. If he would adjudicate the case, he would be guilty of accepting bribery of things. Therefore, he avoided answering their question.
Well, the Rebbe says, why was Moses so busy with asking God? He was able to answer this question. It wasn't such an Einstein question. Everybody could answer it. I mean, you understand, if you don't have sons, you have daughters. So then you can ask God, but at least discuss it. Because they, when they came to him and put the case in front of him, they told him, our father died in the desert. But he wasn't a part of the people who were fighting against you in the Korach uprising. The moment they said it, Moses felt he's biased. And he cannot be objective about giving the answer. That's what he felt. That was the problem. And therefore he turned to God for direction.
You said it was four times Moses...
asking for why.
All those cases are similar?
No.
Okay.
That's interesting. It's all discussion, but no. They are not similar at all.
Any of them, Moses really did not know the answer?
Because I think,
here is
yes.
Like what you said, he
it's clear, yes. Yeah, but I think in the Pesach Sheni, the idea that somebody didn't miss a mitzvah, can do it a month later, is unheard of. Oh, I forgot to fast on Yom Kippur. Can I do it a month later? It doesn't work like this. That's why it was so hard. But here, the commentary say it was because he felt that he's not objective. They gave him bribery. We're all, in last week's parsha, Moses could not give direction because he felt that he's not objective. Yesterday, not a long time ago.
Well, he didn't speak to the right rock. That was 2 ago.
Yeah, that was two. That's old news already. That was 39 years ago. I'm talking about last week. Yeah, I mean, yesterday it was in the same time that this story happened. What was the last story we learned?
Bilam.
And after Bilam tried to curse the Jewish people, didn't work, what he did? What he told Balak to do? What was the next story after the blessings? After Bilam's prophecy. The end of yesterday's parsha.
You want me to be honest? Because last week we were talking about 9th and 17th of...
Tammuz.
So it was not like we were doing the parsha. You know?
You're right. That's my fault. Okay. I don't mind. Yesterday, after the story with Bilam's prophecy...
He told them to marry
He told them the Moabite girls should go and seduce the Jewish boys. Right? And they made them worship idols. And God was very upset. Then came Zimri ben Solom, a leader from the tribe of Shimon, and brought with him a girl from, what was her name? I forgot already what was her name. And he brought her to Moses,
the princess
from Midianite princess. And he brought them to Moses in front of the whole Jewish community. Rashi says, and he asked her, Moses, can I marry her? Moses said, no. said, and you, didn't you marry a Midianite girl? What did he accomplish with it? No matter what Moses will say now, he's already
prejudiced, biased.
He's biased. He's not objective. Oh, you're defending yourself. Shekoyach.
Spoiled the whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was like really, really. That's why he needed Pinchas, as we're going to learn this parsha. Pinchas got up and stopped it. Because Moses couldn't say anything. Moses cried. No matter, Moses could tell him, that was before Mount Sinai. I converted there. But you know, sound bites are very short. You know, they cannot say, and it's a mob mentality. Long explanations don't go anywhere. Can you give an answer in one sentence? It's good. If not, you needed a Pinchas who gave them an answer in one word.
Yeah.
He killed them and finished. Mm. You understand? The point is, and that's the same thing here. Moses was afraid. Maybe they bribed them with words. We're not talking about they gave him money. You know, bribery, real bribery is cash. There is a, you know, there is a, in Torah it's written that a judge that takes bribery gets blind. What means he gets blind? He gets blind to the issue. He doesn't see the truth. You know, you're biased. And the joke, the story goes that once they asked a judge, an old judge who used to take bribery, why is he deaf and not blind? That he said the only promised. I had once a rabbi. He said, people say I'm taking bribes. It's true, but nobody gives. I'm ready to take bribes, but nobody gives. The whole place was laughing. Then here is we're going to read from the Talmud about how much the rabbis, the judges in Jewish law, in Jewish tradition, were careful not to take bribe. Go ahead.
Bribery does not only take the form of money. There's also bribery of things. A judge was once getting into a small boat to cross a river. A person extended his hand and helped him to get on. The person had a case, but the judge told him, I cannot serve as a judge for you. A person
was... You see what happened? Mm-hmm. What was the story? A judge was on a... What was he? On a boat.
Yeah, boat.
And somebody helped him to get up on the boat. He told him, I cannot be your judge. You helped me already. He gave him a hand.
No good deed goes unpunished.
Exactly. Number two, the second story.
A person once removed a feather from his
feather.
Yeah, feather from a judge's scarf. Another person once covered spittle that was laying before the judge. The judges told them, "I cannot serve as a judge for you."
He just moved something. He cleaned up his suit like this. Mm-hmm. He says, I cannot. I even covered something not nice in front of him. He says, I cannot be your judge. And they tell
a
story.
A person once gave a priestly teeth to the judge who was a priest. The judge told him, I cannot serve as a judge for you.
He gave him a gift. You know the tithe, you give the coin? The judge was a coin. And he brought it to him. You know, you can choose. You have gift. Let's say you have to give a tithe from the produce. You can choose to which coin to give. It's up to you. You have to give it to a coin. But which coin to choose, you choose. You can give to Mr. Kaplan. You can look for another coin. This is a coin, by the way. But the moment...
Check
the moment...
I can't take it from you.
Can you always take my money? The people... It happened even lately. Somebody came and wanted to give me a check on Shabbos. Actually, this guy, I tell him always, listen, if it's $1 million check, I would reconsider. Maybe you can find a way. Your little check, take it, send it back during the week. I don't need it. I don't want to touch it. By the way, this guy a few weeks ago, he said he will send me, he bought the check and his cousin who came with him, but told him, the rabbi will not take it from you. He says, I'll send you later. I didn't get it yet. No, maybe the other guys are taking it on the spot are smarter. But the same thing is here. He chose the coin. He never gave the judge the coin that is tight. suddenly gives them. Obviously, it's not. It's considered a bribe. He said, "I don't want to be your judge." You want to read the last story?
A sharecropper. A sharecropper of a field belonging to a judge would bring him figs from his field every Friday. He once came earlier and brought the figs on Thursday because he wanted the judge to adjudicate a case. The judge told him, "I cannot serve as a judge for you." Because the sharecropper brought them earlier than normal, the judge was disqualified, even though the figs belonged to him.
He bought it a day earlier. He stinks. What do you call it? He bought it a day earlier? I cannot be wrong.
It happens just like that today.
What?
The judges are like that just today.
The judges were more careful. Today they're actually taking it. They're actually taking it. Then they didn't take it. But I'll tell you, human beings are human beings. And nobody will, it doesn't mean that 2,000 years ago everybody was righteous. They were corrupt judges then, there's corrupt judges now, there's good judges.
Oh, someone will say, every before and right now, everyone has their price, right?
Hmm. Exactly.
But obviously these cases are brought up because these are the way it should be. And they're.
That's why the rabbi brings, the Talmud brings these stories, what to learn, what to do. To be bad, you don't need a Talmud for. Don't need to. I mean, to be what to do wrong, you don't need a book. Everybody figures out by himself. To do right, that's what you need a book for. That's what you need role models like this rabbis who made themselves. They cannot be judges because they felt that maybe somebody gave them something extra. The power of bribery is it's so powerful that even when you don't know, affects you. You understand?
And even fear of punishment doesn't work. I'll tell you a story. In Russia, as a federal judge, he got caught with corruption. You know, got arrested, put him in jail. Then this is Putin is still telling the story. He says, "We got a new judge." A year later, my people come to me and says, "He's taking bribes too." He says he knows that the previous judge was caught. And it was put in jail. And they, even the fear of, says, and this is happening all the time. Says, my biggest disappointment in my life is in people.
Who said it? Putin?
Putin, yeah.
He doesn't take bribe.
Point is like the funniest part of this story that it comes from that source about
about other people.
Are you kidding me?
He doesn't take bribe.
It's probably true, but for them saying that's like he's against corruption.
He doesn't take bribe. It just takes it. It's not bribe.
Right.
It's his. Everything belongs to him. There is no point of bribe.
Well, is it, the fear of punishment doesn't stop people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I want to tell you a story about...
You're right.
Even people were in the time of the Romans used to do terrible punishments, and still people did the wrong thing. The point is like this: I want to tell you a story about. Was once a rabbi. He was two people came to him for a judgment, for a dispute, a din Torah, and he was listening to them. Then he sent them both out, and he said, "It's too." Understand the law. And you know, in the olden days, they used to take tobacco. Mm-hmm. Tobacco. And smell. Then the rabbi used to smell and he's learning and smell. Then it's empty. And he used to knock on the box was from silver. And the shamish used to come in and take the box and fill it up back. The shamish walks in, picks up the box, is going outside. And outside is a snowstorm. Terrible. And he's putting on his coat because there was no more tobacco in the house. He had to go to the store. And the shamish is already an old man. Then one of the guys tells him, I'll bring the tobacco for the rabbi. Why you need to go? He says, no, I'll go. No, it doesn't. No, I will go. I'm much younger than you. I'm stronger. I'll go. Okay, he went. He went, he bought the tobacco, he gave it to the shamish walks in, gives it to the rabbi. The rabbi, fine, the rabbi continues and he takes the smell. And suddenly, as he goes and he's looking into the, it was all the time, he was leaning towards one of the two sides. suddenly start to think, maybe the other side is right, maybe the other side is right. They start to look in books, and he's getting more confused and more confused, and he doesn't know, and he's taking more tobacco. And then he takes something, and he feels there is something there. He picks up the golden coin inside the tobacco box. He calls the shamash and says, "Tell me, who bought the tobacco?" Says, "Yeah, to his mate." The other guy told him, he told him, "You're fired right now." He said, from the moment, before he knew that the money there, the moment they brought the tobacco to him, he already, bribery affects you, even when somebody puts you without you knowing some money in your pocket. It already affects your way of thinking. That's why bribery is such power. And therefore, I love the people running around. I'm objective. Well, sure, you're objective. Everybody's objective. The objective person was not born yet. Okay. Now we learn what the Rebbe says about that. Continue.
Now think about it. On one hand, who is greater than Moses? The Torah was transmitted through him from Sinai to all generations. Every great Torah scholar owes his scholarship and the authority that comes along with it to the fact that Moses transmitted the Torah to Joshua, who in turn transmitted it to the elders, and so on, through the 40 generations of the Torah's transmission, as listed by Maimonides in his introduction to Mishnah Torah, and in the generations that followed. Moreover, this episode took place in the 40th year, when Moses reached his zenith, having received the entire Torah. After all, some Torah concepts were revealed after the revelation at Sinai, throughout the 40 years in the desert. But by the 40th year, he had received the entire Torah, reaching the pinnacle of his perfection.
The Rebbe is building up, who was Moses? The person who gave the Torah to the old Jewish people, all the generations. It's all about Moses. Every Judaism is based about Moses. And this happened by the end of the 4 years. And Moses already was teaching Torah, and he knew all the answers, and he knew God taught him over the 4 years new things. If so,
he should have responded to the query of Tzelafchad's daughters. He was also surely aware that a scholar is obligated by Jewish law to respond to questions when they come before him.
You see, there is a law that if a rabbi who knows the answers doesn't give an answer, he's being punished. Because you're not allowed not to lead the Jewish people, not to teach the Jewish people. Rabbis who don't know the answer, give the answer, they're also punished. Also a terrible thing. When you don't know, don't pretend that you know. But if you know and you don't want to, you want to give for whatever reason, you're not allowed to deny from the Jewish people your knowledge that you know. You have to direct them, you have to guide them in Judaism. Go ahead.
It was a question posed not by one person, but by five, Tzelafchad's five daughters, and posed in the presence of the elders and the entire community. Furthermore, it was regarding an essential matter for the Jewish people in general, and for that generation in particular, the matter of settling the land of Israel. We know of its importance from Moses' own discussion with the tribes of Gad and Reuben. If so, according to the Torah of Moses, he had the obligation and the right to answer the question on his own.
Then Moses had to answer. What do you mean he doesn't answer? They ask him a question. You're the rabbi, you're the judge, you better answer. Continue.
Bribery of things, the women's statement that their father was not among Korach's group was inconsequential. Korach's rebellion took place 39 years earlier. Even at the time, Moses didn't feel that he needed endorsement from human beings to prove his legitimacy. He relied on God himself. He said, God will demonstrate, God will create an opening in the ground, and that indeed happened. When that occurred, even Korach and his party couldn't deny his legitimacy. 39 years later, Moses' leadership was unquestionable. There was no inherent flattery in affirming his authority.
What was Moses afraid? They told him, our father was not a part of the Korach people. It's 39 years later, God proved that he was right. Moses did not need their endorsement for not one inch. The whole idea that they bribed them is a joke. Mm-hmm. It's nothing. Even then, when there was a story of Korach, he didn't need anybody. When you have God on your side, you don't need anybody to agree with you. I want to tell you something interesting. Now, why the Jewish people don't try to convert to Judaism? They're not in business of conversion. Because when you have the truth, you don't need more people to prove that you're right. You understand what I'm saying? If I'm not sure about myself, I need you to say that I'm smart, and you to say that I'm smart, and you to say that I'm smart. But if I think that I'm smart, and I know that I'm smart because I got the Nobel Prize, I don't need anybody to agree with me. If I'm the real scientists, don't care, right? They are not in the business of proving their geniusness. They are so involved in it, they couldn't care less. They don't need that.
I wish you were right. It was a long time ago. Our current scientists only care about...
Some of them. There is plenty of geniuses who don't care. Who don't care at all. At least there were some of them, right? Okay, there was in the olden days. There were the good olden days. There were people like this. There is two type of people. There are people who need their affirmation that they are good and they are smart, and there are people who don't need it, right? Then Moses was from the type of people. Then the Jewish people, as a religion, we got it from God at Mount Sinai. It's not going to change if we have 50 million Jews or we have 100 million Jews or we have 5 Jews. The truth is the truth. Some other religions are very much in the business that everybody should agree with them and everybody should convert to them because they're not sure about it. It's a sign of insecurity. That's what it is. But the Jewish people doesn't make a difference. Moses, God told them to be Moses. They didn't care if what Korach says. I mean, he was upset about it. And especially after Korach was punished, there's nothing to be afraid of. And 39 years later, when his authority is 150%, the few women come and tell him, the 5 daughters say, you know, our father was not about from the people who are fighting you. That's not even bribery. That's nothing. That should stop him from giving the right ruling. That's the question. Nonetheless,
they made mention the fact that their father hadn't questioned Moses' legitimacy 39 years early. In the moments before that, ground opened up, and it was still a reasonable assessment adopted by Korach, his party, and 250 prominent leaders, as Rashi points out. Therefore, Moses did not want to judge their case. He did not want to be suspect of any bribery or things that could potentially tilt his decision, despite being the incontestable Moses, Moshe Rabbeinu.
See, Moses was afraid, maybe even if it's not a lot of bribery, maybe somehow in subconscious it will affect his judgment. You know, there are certain things, as I said, like the guy who got the tobacco and he didn't even know, but that's already started to drive him crazy. Certain things you think you're objective, you don't even know that you're not objective. The best example, maybe I gave it, you know, there is a Jewish law that says, then in biblical time, you know, the next year is going to be a leap year. A leap year in Jewish calendar is an extra month. Next year is an extra month. In biblical times, in Talmudic times, they used to decide if this year is going to be a leap year. Now it's a calendar, it's a system. Then they used to come together, the rabbis, and make the decision. 7 great rabbis, and they used to make the decision. And everybody, it was a big event. Then the Talmud says, Jewish law tells us, 2 people cannot be a part of the decision making. The king and the high priest. The king wanted it to be a leap year because he has to give the salaries by the year. He gets a leap year. For free, why not? Sure, he wants a leap year. The high priest doesn't want a leap year. Why? The Talmud says something very interesting. If a leap year, the high holidays is later, right? A month later.
That's what I was about to ask. Is it everything will be later?
Yeah. The leap year, the month that we add is before Pesach. That Pesach is later, Shavuos is later, Rosh Hashanah. Next year, everything will be later. This year, Rosh Hashanah is Labor Day. It's the earliest ever. Next year, it's going to be a month later. It'll be like beginning of October. Mm-hmm. Then why he doesn't want a month later? is going to the mikveh. On Yom Kippur, the high priest is to go to the mikveh in Jerusalem. He had to toivel in the water 5 times during the same day on Yom Kippur. He was afraid the water would be a little colder. Then the Rebbe said once, he pointed out to somebody, he said, look, the degrees how cold or warm it's going to be in Jerusalem is not such a big difference.
It's going to be 85, 90.
Not 80, but it still be warm. Nothing to worry about. No, and they used to warm up the water. It's not like, you know, it's not like he's losing $1 million or something. Mm. A little colder. That the high priest who is entering the Holy of Holies, you really think about the cold water, subconsciously, it will affect him. That's what bribery is, a subconscious thing. People say, I did it for the right reason. Sure. Nobody can say I did it for the right reason. Nobody even can say such a thing. That's what Moses is trying to teach us here. Continue. Moses wrote
this story in the Torah, the written Torah, which means that it is a lesson for every single Jewish man and woman. It tells us how careful we must be to avoid bribery, even in a consequential form of bribery, like trivial flattery, to a person of the greatness of Moses. I have a question. Was in Israel, or how many times was it often?
The Rebbe was never in Israel.
He was never
in Israel? Never in Israel.
Okay, what's the main reason for that?
Main reason. Many reasons.
Main reason. I'm asking you. You have to tell the truth.
I'll tell you.
He won't be able to come back.
Very good. The Rebbe said, if you go there for over 30 days, you cannot come back. You see, to leave the Holy Land, you need to have a good reason. There are 3 reasons you're allowed to leave the Holy Land. Or because you need a job, you cannot make a living in Israel. Or because you have to get married, you cannot find a shidduch in Israel. Or because you want to learn Torah from a rabbi that you cannot find in Israel.
I think you actually mentioned that before.
Yes.
Okay.
I had all the three reasons. I went to learn Torah by the Rebbe. Then I got married in America. Then I found a job here. But I'll tell you the real reason. You want to know the real reason? I'll tell you the real reason. The Rebbe felt that in America, he can. America needs him more. Here, he can control the whole world. He can make fight assimilation in America much bigger. In Israel, the assimilation is not such a big threat. In America, it's much bigger.
No. But you told this before. But I mean, I'm talking about why he couldn't go, like, not for 30 days, for 2 weeks.
For two weeks, the Rebbe didn't want to go to Israel. If he goes, he goes. He's not going for 2 weeks. He goes because it's the right thing to do. If you have to go to Israel, you go to Israel. But you don't go. Israel is not a touring spot. Israel is the Holy Land.
It's not
a
tourist place, right?
It's not a tourist place. That's what the Rebbe said many times. Don't go to Israel because it's a tourist place. He told it to many people.
But if he would go, let's say, just genuinely, how he will be met there? Because it's a tons of religious parties and everything. And Lubavitch is, Hasidic, for that portion of this, everyone knows how it's big in diaspora, whatever. But in Israel, how he will
Chabad, there's a lot of Chabad in Israel, nothing to worry. And the Rebbe would be met great. But the Rebbe didn't want to, that's a part of it. He didn't want to get involved with fights with Jews and all of these things.
Because it will create some kind of...
And ultimately, the Rebbe said his father-in-law was buried in New York, and he wanted to go to his gravesite all the time. He never wanted to leave him. And ultimately, the truth of all truth, you remember we learned 2 weeks ago that Moses didn't enter the land of Israel. He was buried in the desert, and when Moshiach will come, he will go to Israel. When Moshiach will come, the Rebbe will go to the Holy Land. And before that, he wanted to wait until...
He's still supporting people here, right?
Exactly. The Rebbe, the land of Israel is the land of Israel when Moshiach comes. When there is no temple there, and there is no Moshiach there, it's a nice place, it's a holy land, but it's not on the level that we wanted. Then as long as the Jews are in exile, the Rebbe is with the Jews in exile... And when everybody will go to the land, when the last Jew will leave the diaspora, then the Rebbe will come with him.
I'm pretty sure I'm not the first one, and not the thousandth one who was asking this guy.
Not the 10,000th one. And the Rebbe gave many answers. The Rebbe said many times, he said to Arik Sharon, as the Rebbe said, the Rebbe told him the captain is the last one to leave the sinking boat. That's one. The Rebbe answered to a child that the doctor goes wherever he's needed, not wherever it's good for him. Bottom line is, the Rebbe didn't look where is to live where he wants, We recently, the Rebbe once told somebody, I cannot even pick up a telephone to Moscow from Israel at that time. I can do it from America.
Was there any implication that the Mashiach would appear in America and not in Israel?
In exile, yeah. The Rebbe said it a few times, that Mashiach was... It could start from exile. The point doesn't make a difference where it will come. When Moshiach will come, he will go to the land of Israel. Wherever he'll come, he'll come. Until then, to go there for a visit, the Rebbe didn't believe in tourism in Israel. Israel is the holy land. And the Rebbe didn't go anywhere. For 4 years, the Rebbe was every day in his office. You know this? 4 years, every day.
We're not talking about U.S. You're talking about whatever. Where was his office? By the Brooklyn?
In 770. He lived 2 blocks away. Every day. Yom Kippur, Tisha B'Av, Rosh Hashanah. No vacations, no nothing. Every day. No sickness, no cold, no nothing. Every day the Rebbe was in 770. 40 years. You know what it means? 42 years.
It's a groundhog day.
Now even the other Chabad rabbis were not like this, and not the Rebbe was there because he felt he needs. The Rebbe wanted to bring Moshiach, and he put all his effort in doing, making the Jews better Jews to deserve the coming of Moshiach. And therefore, he was so busy and not giving himself one break. He used to come to the office 10 o'clock in the morning, leave most of the years. The regular time to go home was 12 o'clock at night. He used to go in the middle for supper and come back.
But we know in generally when person like being in the same place, he kind of losing the feeling of what's going on around. It's the one thing you hear.
It's interesting.
Like, you kind of feel it yourself.
Interesting that you say it. Interesting that you say.
You know?
I can tell you that the Rebbe, the whole shul was full with people 20 years old. The Rebbe was 80. When I was there, 85, 86, 87. The Rebbe was the youngest person in the room. He had the most innovative ideas than anybody can come up. The whole Chabad outreach is the Rebbe. And we were just doing. Oh, another thing. The Rebbe came up with new ideas every Monday and Thursday. And the most innovative, you know, the big menorahs outside. All the ideas, all the innovation of Chabad comes from the Rebbe. And the Rebbe is to like be disappointed with the people who are not holding up with his innovation. Then the Rebbe didn't understand. The Rebbe met in the last 7 years, six years. The Rebbe was giving dollars to people every day, every Sunday. He met 1,000 people every Sunday. He heard everything you want. I saw the bags that the Rebbe used to get from mail. And before that, the Rebbe used to meet people 3 times a week, people at private audience with the Rebbe. From 8 started 8 o'clock at night, could continue until 4 o'clock in the morning, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, sometimes 7 o'clock in the morning. The Rebbe saw every night 50 people, 3 times a week, from all walks of life. You think he lost contact?
So connected.
The Rebbe knew what's going on more than anybody in the world. And anybody walked in about his own topic, the Rebbe interviewed them and talked to him. And the Rebbe knew exactly. And then the Rebbe spoke in public. Where do the Rebbe speak for? The Rebbe's thousands of hours of speeches. Thousands.
But you're saying it's the same principle. Okay, you explain why he wouldn't go to Israel, because in Israel this and this and this. But not going like somewhere where he could thought. He could be like really important if he will visit, you know, kind of.
Because now the Rebbe said that anybody who wants him will come to him. And therefore, instead of him going to visit, you know, he visited the whole world. He sent emissaries. He sent Chabad rabbis. Everyone empowered them to go everywhere. That the Rebbe was everywhere, actually. He was in the office, but he was really was everywhere. And the Rebbe made an impact everywhere in the world. See, the previous, some Hasidic rabbis of Chabad traveled a lot. It's almost one traveled, one didn't. The Baal Shem Tov traveled all over. The Magid stayed in one place. He didn't travel. The Alter Rebbe traveled. And that was the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, who came to America in 1930 for a visit. He traveled over the United States. He was in Chicago. He was in New York. He was in Boston. He was in Massachusetts. He was in Detroit. He was in many places. And then even when he came again, then he was already sick. But he traveled all over Europe. He traveled and traveled and traveled. The Rebbe was just the opposite. The Rebbe came to New York. He came down from the boat in 1941 and he stayed in New York and finished. And even when before he became Rebbe, somebody tried to convince him he should go for a vacation for a little bit. The Rebbe said, I have a chance to see my father-in-law every day, I'll go on a vacation. You understand? Mm-hmm. But he was made from it's a whole different human being. The commitment that the Rebbe showed and had was something unbelievable. It's like the Rebbe didn't have to tell anybody what to do. He inspired people by his own example. When the Rebbe walked into the room, just by being like him, you were inspired. And a little humble too, on top of it. a lot. He walked into the room, everything else became meaningless. You understand? The moment he walked in, before that, my problems were so important. The world comes to an end. The Rebbe walked in, suddenly all the other things became stupid.
But you see, with this kind of and you always gave us an idea how you felt about it. And this is very, very kind of strong. But he created this void, which is kind of there. And in normal kind of scenarios, someone else taking the place and this one. But with this kind of devotion to who he was and everything, he created a void.
This is true. He created a void, yes. Nobody can get into the Rebbe's shoes.
Right.
No question about that. But he empowered everybody to continue his work. Actually, his work is growing. There is generations of young Hasidim who never saw the Rebbe like my children, and they are more devoted than I am.
But did he have an idea of the will of something who is going to take the place or the structure per se?
Yeah. He set up a structure, and he told also the Hasidim, if you have a question, if it's a lucky question, and we're going to read about it in a minute, actually. Okay. We'll get to it. Okay. Continue.
Yeah. If this is true of Moses, it is certainly true of ourselves. Ordinary people are wholly incomparable to the greatness of Moses. Also, our bribery and biases are not...
only incomparable? That's a word completely not comparable? I never knew the word. How you say it? Holy?
Holy
incomparable.
Holy incomparable. What's holy means? Completely not?
Completely.
Fully.
Uh-huh. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Are not memories from 39 years ago, but matters of current import, which are relevant at this very moment. It is beyond a doubt that we cannot rely on our own judgment. We must consult with someone greater than ourselves. As the Mishnah says, appoint a teacher for yourself.
Asei lecha rav, make yourself a teacher. The Rebbe is speaking about it. The Rebbe started the campaign when I was by the Rebbe. Then everyone should appoint himself a teacher, a rabbi. Then everybody says, Rebbe, you're a rabbi, a rabbi. I said, no. I don't have time for all your little problems. Hmm. You need somebody else. Everyone should have a rabbi and ask him what to do. That was a part you're asking how the Rebbe set up a structure. You see, Hasidim were completely dependent on the Rebbe for every question. And then as the years came and the Rebbe saw that will be no other Rebbe, the Rebbe set up systems how people will survive and live on without him. And he said one of the things is that every chassid, men, women, everyone should have a rabbi. Why you need a rabbi? I can make decisions. Continue.
You can appoint a mentor to your liking. The Mishnah said, appoint a teacher. You make the choice, but he must be greater than yourself, and you must commit to accept his judgment and to follow his
opinion. Ah, you're not to say, I appoint myself a rabbi, but I don't like what he says, I look for another rabbi. You have to find a rabbi and you look and listen to him. Why?
It could be very difficult to make this commitment. After all, nobody is smarter than yourself. Indeed, the Mishnah says appoint using the Hebrew term aseh, which implies coercion. But you certainly have the ability to do it because God does not request that which is not within our power.
Why you need that? Why the rabbi said you should appoint a rabbi? Because a person is not objective. And he makes decisions what are good for him. then you have to ask anybody else. Is objective. He doesn't care. If I come to ask you, should I go to New York or not go? You tell me. Yeah, tell me what the case is. I'll tell you what makes sense. He does not. He's not biased. When I make a decision for myself, I'm biased. They said, "Asei lechorav, make yourself a rabbi." Who? I don't care who. Not you.
There's two problems with it.
Yeah.
The first problem is, as it pointed out, nobody's smarter than yourself.
That's what you think.
No. Well, right. But that idea stays with you for a very long time in your life. Only after making a lot of mistakes you realize, well...
That's why you need a rabbi to tell you, make yourself a rabbi, exactly this.
But then there's another problem, a second problem. There's two problems, right? Yeah. There's the first problem. The second problem, because we're foolish, especially when we're young. And the second problem is, how do you find a person who you would listen to 100% of the time on all the subjects? There's so many subjects. Somebody has a very good authority in this area.
Somebody has a very good this person on every subject.
Okay. The person will not give you advice on every subject that he doesn't understand. For example, the Rebbe said, if you have a medical question, you ask a doctor. And you ask two doctors. If the two doctors disagree, you ask a third doctor and you go by the majority. Or you ask a doctor who is a good friend of you. Why a doctor is a good friend of you? He will care. Even if he's not the biggest, and he will care enough to do the research and find out. The Rebbe said, if it's a business matter, you go to business people and you ask them what they think. A friend of you is a businessman. And he will try to give you the answer that he feels is right. And when you ask a rabbi, if he's a normal rabbi, he will tell you, oh, it's a medical question. I don't have an answer for it. I want to hear as a doctor. I know some good doctors. Go and ask them. And you come back and tell me what he says, and I will help you to make a decision.
Okay. The rabbi is really just spiritual area of your life, right?
No, the rabbi will guide you in everything, but it doesn't mean he is to give every answer. You understand? A true rabbi knows that he doesn't know everything.
A good doctor sends you to a specialist.
Exactly.
Right. I'm not talking about even doctors.
No. He says just like a doctor would be a rabbi. The rabbi, to be such a rabbi that he tells you, you know, many times people come asking a question, I don't want to make the decision. I tell them, I think you should go ask this and this person. I'm not a real psychologist. I don't listen. I'm not a professional. I don't know what to tell you. You have to ask somebody who understands this. Or his Shalom Bayit problems, things like this. Sometimes you have to go to a professional.
Right.
Yes, I mean...
But how finish already. Rabbis from the whole world, from Varshavs, was like relying on the rabbi's
advice. Yes.
Now they looking in their own. How that's working for?
Listen, I'll tell you. The rabbi left so much direction. There is 40 volumes of letters, with directions. There is. Teachings, there is books, there's hundreds of books of the Rebbe's teaching and opinions.
You're saying they find an answer if there is there?
Everybody knows what the Rebbe wants. Sometimes they make themselves like they don't know, but they know very well. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows what the Rebbe would say. You ask anybody, you tell them, put yourself, close your eyes, think about the Rebbe, and ask, and you tell me. If what you do is the right thing.
But that will be and not, here. He'll be listening to themselves. The answer.
Even if he will listen to himself, he will know the truth. Many people pretend that they, the Rebbe will do this, and the Rebbe will do this. Everybody knows the truth. That's why you need a rabbi, because you're not objective. That you find excuses, the Rebbe would be on your side. Then you ask somebody else, and he tells you, you know the truth. And there is so much teaching, there is almost impossible to find. Yeah, people ask what the Rebbe would say about COVID. That was such a unusual thing. I don't know what the Rebbe would say. I cannot tell you what the Rebbe would say about COVID. But I know what the Rebbe would say how to handle COVID. You understand what I'm saying? What to do? Don't give up. Move on. Try your best. Be optimistic about life. And so, I mean, what to do with the tragedy, the Rebbe would tell you.
Yes.
Even freeze to death. What can go to them?
So I think it's the whole, it's a strong lesson, it's to seek advice.
And not rely on your own prejudice on the items.
Exactly. Anytime, and it's especially the more important the decision is, you should ask and seek advice. Yes. Don't make your own decision. Oh, I know everything. Ask advice.
But you see, if it was something super, super important, you would probably want to go and ask.
Absolutely, I would ask the Rebbe.
But right now, you don't have this.
Yeah, that's now I go to the oil, to the Rebbe's gravesite. I pray that I should get the right decision, made the right decision. Yeah, that's what I do. Yeah. I mean, we don't have the Rebbe. Yeah, I give it to you.
I'll take one home.
No problem.